And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, June the 1st, first day of June 2016, 12:11, coming up on 12:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And this is going to be a fun program over the next 2 hours. I'm Scott Spears, by the way, with you here on the Now program. And you could call this somewhat of a medical show today. Going to tell you what's coming up in hour number two this afternoon. We are going to be joined by 96-year-old Dr. Henry Heimlich, inventor of the Heimlich Maneuver. Dr. Heimlich is 96 years old. He has moved into a retirement center. On May the 23rd, an 87-year-old woman who was seated at Dr. Heimlich's table at dinner started to choke, and Dr. Heimlich used the maneuver to save her life. We'll hear more about that in hour number two. Also going to touch in hour number two on a very interesting press conference yesterday that Donald Trump had discussing money he had raised for the veterans, which is very good, but a kind of shootout that he had with the media. We'll listen to that. Maybe take some of your phone calls. So that's all coming up next hour. This hour, we're joined by one of my favorite people. He's been on the show before. For many years, you watched him on the Today Show as he was their medical expert. Today, he joins us to talk about what's going on in his life, something very interesting he and his wife are doing. And we're also going to touch on several topics that are of high interest these days. Alzheimer's, diets, certainly with the summer coming up here, are just upon us in 21 days, and depression, which also sets in on people the more and more we see as time goes on. He's Dr. Art Uhlein. Dr. Uhlein, how are you?
I am well, Scott. Thank you very much for asking.
Good to speak with you. How has life been as we approach summer 2016?
Well, life has never been better, and as I approach summer 2016, I'm looking at turning 80. I turn 80 in July. I feel like a kid after hearing you talk about Henry Heimlich. But it's kind of a milestone summer for me because I've spent the last few months trying to decide what to do with, quotes, the rest of my life, end quotes. And it's just been a fascinating exercise.
What have you come up with?
Well, I've come up with a number of things, and we're now coning in. My wife and I have decided at the age of 80, and I can't tell you her age. She won't allow it, but she's 3 years younger than I am. we're starting an adventure trekking company. For the last few years, we have been doing high-altitude treks ourselves. We celebrated my 75th birthday at the summit of Kilimanjaro, and each year we've gone back to a different glacier in South America and have gone over 17,000 feet on each trip. And our guide, the fellow who owns the company, has convinced us that we should be leading more seniors up these mountains. He has agreed to create a special itinerary, special programs that increase the safety factor, and we're going to do it as our next adventure in life.
Why was this particular adventure appealing to you?
Well, I have to tell you, there were actually, this was just one of 17 adventures that were appealing to me. I really got serious about this. I've been kind of pretty much laying low for the last 3 years. I have been working on an internet weight loss program that was a wonderful success scientifically, but a total failure business-wise. And so the question was, what do I do next? And I was out with an engineer friend of mine, another 80-year-old, a civil engineer who built factories all over the world. And he said, well, how are you going about this? Well, you know, I'm thinking about this, and I'm wondering about that, and I'm mulling on this. He says, you're doing it just like a doctor would, stupidly. He said, that's not the way you decide an important issue like the rest of your life. And, well, how would you do it? He said, well, I'd do it the same way I decided where to build factories. He actually supervised the construction of glass factories around the world for Corning. And I said, all right, tell me how you do that. He said, well, you kind of get a spreadsheet, and in the first column, you put the list of things you're considering. And I put 17 things on that list. And Scott, I have to tell you that radio spots was one of the things on that list. You and I have talked about doing radio spots, short one-minute spots, and that was pretty high on the list because I love radio. And so that's the first column. You list all 17 things. In the second column, you put must-have, and you identify three or four characteristics that an opportunity must have, and if the opportunity doesn't have them, it's automatically canceled. It doesn't matter how sexy it looks. It doesn't matter how much you think you want to do it. It's gone if it doesn't have those. In the next column, you put cannot have, must not have. And if the opportunity has one of those things, then you can't do it. I'll give you an example. On my must-have list, it must have reasonable support for the administrative workload. I mean, frankly, I'm tired of typing my own mail. It must have reasonable support for the expenses, because my wife is tired of me spending money on my fanciful projects. And the third must-have was it must be fun, stimulating, interesting, and personally rewarding in a societal sense. It's got to do some good for somebody. In the must not have column, I said it must not involve a significant personal financial investment. That's my wife's rule. It must not have Gracie. And Gracie is the code name for a person a very objectionable person whom I found very offensive in another project I was on, and I have vowed that I will never again, as long as I live, work with another Gracie. And finally, it must not have an overwhelming work or travel schedule. I've been there, done that. 4 million miles on airplanes between LA and New York. So those are the first two columns, and then the next few columns are wants. What kinds of things do you want? And my wants were it had to have some social significance. It had to be easy to pursue. I don't want to beat my head into walls. It had to have some spillover effect. I kind of rated all these things, and some are more important than others, so you assign numerical values to them. And I went through this for all 17 items, and immediately eliminated four of them. And to boil this long story down, the thing that came right to the very top of the list when I looked at it numerically and mathematically was starting a high-altitude trekking company for seniors.
Are seniors not moving enough these days?
Oh, my God, Scott. All you got to do is open your eyes and look around you, and you'll see a tragedy unfolding. Look at the people who are kind of shuffling along. In fact, this is a very important medical measure as people get older. If the distance, if their step span decreases, that's a sign of instability. Look at the rate at which they're walking. If the pace of their gait decreases, you're looking at a person who is declining in function. My wife and I on Sunday climbed 1,300 stairs. Now, we're just getting warmed up to our serious workout level. When just before we're about to do a mountain climb, we will climb 2,000 stairs in a day. So we were just, it was a light workout, 2,000 stairs. I look around me at older people, and they'll take the escalator in part because they find it too hard to get up the stairs. This is a tragedy unfolding. because if older people don't use their muscles, you know what happens. They lose them.
Well, here's the question I have, because I always wonder this. How does an old person become an old person? Because at some point, they're a young person, so at what point do they say, I don't want to take the steps anymore?
That's a really powerful question. In my opinion, it is the most important question you could ask, and the answer will surprise you. It starts in youth. There's been a fascinating study going on at Yale University for the last 30, 40 years. A researcher named Becca Levy, about 35, 40 years ago, asked a whole bunch of people in their 30s what they expected out of aging. What was their vision of aging? And, you know, some people, oh, man, I can't wait to get older. I'll have the time to do the things I want. I'll be able to do my hobbies. And, of course, there was a group at the other end that said, oh, I dread aging. It's a period of decline. I know I'll be, you know, I expect to get sick. And they compared the people in the top quintile, the top 20%, the most positive 20%, with the most negative 20%, and they've been following these people for 35, 40 years. And the people with the most positive expectations of aging live on average 7.5 years longer than the people with the most negative expectations 35 years earlier. They looked at their ability to recover from illness and from surgery. And the people who had the most positive outlook 35 years earlier did far better in recovering than the people with the most negative attitude. So the answer to your question is, Scott, it's all in your head, and it starts in your youth.
If I am 80 years old and I notice that I'm already shuffling and I'm worried of falling and I can't take the steps, how do I reverse that?
One step at a time. You start stepping more. You start working a little harder. You climb one stair today, two stairs tomorrow, three stairs the next day. And in a few months, you'll find yourself walking 6, 8, 10 flights. You'll find yourself able to get out of a chair without struggling to push yourself up with your arms. You'll find yourself enjoying the walks. You'll find yourself recovering when you stumble instead of going down to the ground. We've got this mentality in this country that it all has to happen quickly. I'm 100 pounds overweight, I have to lose it by tomorrow. I'm totally out of shape, I need to keep up with Art Uhlin by next weekend. Wrong. One step at a time.
Something that I cannot really understand is it seemed like in the 80s and the 90s, I remember Phil Donahue doing this, and you probably do as well because you were in the media at that point. Phil Donahue used to have doctors on, and I've never really seen anybody do this since, but he used to have doctors on, and they would talk about, you know, double-check your doctor. Go to another doctor, get a second opinion, even if it's not life or death. And then I even remember he would do shows, Doctors Who Hate Donahue, because people were doing checkups for the first time. It seems like now, when people go to a doctor, and I'll give you an example. When people go to a doctor now, they go in for, everybody does a blood test. Anytime something's wrong, a blood test is done. And maybe they're not checking for everything, because I know a lot of cancers show up on blood tests, because your white blood cell count will be elevated. But that's not what the doctor's looking for, so they don't even look at that. Does a lot of that go on? Are people not checking their doctors anymore?
Well, yeah, some of that is going on. Actually, I think more people are double checking now. They're going to the internet for information. I think that more people are getting second opinions for critical illnesses, and I think that's a very, very wise thing to do. I'll tell you the problem I have with people and their doctors, and that is this notion that it's you wait until something hurts or till a blood test is abnormal before you do anything about it. As you know, nearly 70% of Americans are overweight or obese at this time today in our country. But a study was done of American physicians, family doctors, to see what percentage of them actually spoke to their patients about their obesity during a visit. Now, obesity increases your risk of heart disease, cancer, kidney disease, blind eye. You know, I could go on and on. I won't bore you with the list. It's a critically important issue, but only 30% of American physicians talked to their patients about their obesity during the visit. I find that shocking. By the way, if the doctor was overweight himself or herself, and about 35% of American physicians are overweight, it's better than the general public, but still a problem. If the doctor was overweight himself, then only 19% of those doctors talked to their patients about weight.
Well, and I'm not saying doctors are miracle workers, but something that I notice in a lot of senior citizens is maybe in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, they haven't seen doctors a whole lot before that, but they'll develop something that may be chronic, you know, high blood pressure, cholesterol, depression, which I'd like to talk about, or they might have open heart surgery, something like that, to where they do need to check back with the doctor once every month, once every 2 months. You know, they go to the doctor more regularly. Now, they start that maybe at 50 years old, and then at 80, they develop something that, you know, the doctor did not see coming. And I guess that's the confusion that I have, because if you're seeing a doctor regularly for what are basically checkups, are they looking for things like the development of cancers? Are they looking for things? Because we've all heard the stories of he didn't see a doctor for 20 years and he had a pain and there was cancer. If you're going to a doctor regularly for something like blood pressure, diabetes, check on an open heart surgery that maybe you had in your 50s, are they checking for that other stuff? Because early detection is so important.
Well, I think they are checking. I think American medicine is generally good in that area. But I've got to tell you, I am troubled by the lack of personal responsibility for one's own health. I am troubled by the fact that someone might be 100 pounds overweight, and you know at least five people, who will go to the doctor month after month for blood pressure medicines, for diabetes medicines, for pain pills to deal with the arthritis, when taking off the 100 pounds would cure all of those problems. So it bothers me to think, well, it's the doctor's job to save us from these things. We're all going to die, Scott.
This is true.
It's only a question of when. And I am reminded of the greatest gift I've ever received was a message given to me by my medical school roommate just before he died 20 years ago. He died at the age of 60 of lung cancer, although he never smoked. And I went to visit him. I made his wife promise me she'd call me when it was time to say goodbye, and she did. He lived a few hours away in Fresno, and she said, "I think you better get up here." So I drove up, and he and I spent 3-4 hours together laughing, reminiscing. I mean, it was really beautiful time. He was in terrible shape, though, and finally it was clear he was exhausted, and I said, "Tom, it's time to go. It's time to say goodbye." And we hugged and kissed and said goodbye, and I got to the door, and he called out. He said, "Hey, Art." I said, "What is it?" He said, "I got a question to ask you." I said, "Go ahead." He said, "If you learned today that you only had 4 more weeks to live, would you spend the next 4 weeks the same way you spent the last four? I was like, oh, wow. I don't know, Tom. I never thought about that. He says, well, here's what I need you to know. He says, you know I don't have 4 weeks. I said, I know. He died 10 days later. He said, what I need you to know is that you don't have a guarantee on the next four. So take care of yourself. Live every day well. Great message.
It is. And you know, it's interesting. And I guess maybe where, because there are two questions I want to stem off of this. The first one is, it's interesting that you bring up lung cancer. And maybe this is where I was going before. You're right. A doctor should not have to tell you if you are overweight and this is, you know, going to be a problem for you. But something like lung cancer, for example, and sometimes in people who never smoke, but certainly in people who do smoke as well. If you go to the hospital, and let's say you have something wrong with your lungs, let's say pneumonia or just something, you know, you can't breathe real well, and they do a chest x-ray. The doctor does a chest x-ray. Now, shouldn't on that x-ray, if there is cancer in there, they be able to see that? Are they looking for that?
Yes, they're looking for it, but should they be able to see it if it's really very, very early? They may not see it at all. No, it may not show up at all on a chest x-ray. Chest x-rays are not recommended at all for people at low risk, because you got to take a million x-rays to find that one cancer. You do more damage with the radiation than you do with recovery. And I know that the person, that one person who might have the lung cancer detected, is saying, hey, wait a minute, that could save my life. In fact, when you look at the statistics, it turns out to be a very poor screening test among low-risk individuals. It's kind of like the PSA test for prostate cancer. I go to an incredibly fine urologist, young man, PhD, MD, and as soon as I get in, you know, the technician comes in and says, with a needle. He's got a syringe and a needle. And she says, what are you going to do with that? She says, well, I need a sample of blood for your PSA test. I said, you're not taking my PSA test. Well, the doctor ordered it. He orders it routinely. I said, that's fine. You send the doctor in, and you just tell him I refused it, and he comes in, of course, laughing, and he said, well, you did the right thing. I'm 80 years old. If I live long enough, I'm going to have prostate cancer, but that's not what's going to kill me. So there are these nuances in medicine, you know. Should they have found a lung cancer on my chest x-ray? Why now, a year later, here it is? Was it there then? It might have been there then, but it maybe it was only 18 cells, 26 cells, 100 cells, invisible to an x-ray. So nothing's perfect. No. Nothing is perfect.
Well, I guess in the grand scheme of things, what I'm getting at is that if it doesn't show up on an x-ray, it's probably not big. Maybe treatable at that point. Maybe it's not a good screening device for something like lung cancer, but if you were in... because I think this is where a lot of people get lost, a lot of senior citizens. If you go in to the hospital with an illness, and an affect of that illness is trouble breathing, now, they'll do a chest x-ray, and they'll do, I'm sure, blood work, and they'll do... At some point in that, shouldn't that be something they're looking for in a senior citizen?
Yes, and they will find it. If you've got symptoms, if you actually have pulmonary symptoms, and with lung cancer, the most likely symptom is going to be a cough, a persistent cough. You get a cough, and you're coughing for 2 days. Come on, you know, you probably got a little viral bronchitis. You get a cough that lasts for 2 weeks, it's time to see the doctor. And there's a very good chance that you've got a lesion, and they're going to find it. So, but what we see people ignoring the cough for months. We see people going to the doctor. This is a very real thing, and I don't mean this in a critical fashion. And they've had a cough for 2 months, and they're afraid that they have lung cancer, but they won't tell the doctor. Because if it's there, it's magical thinking. If I really have cancer, he'll find it. He'll listen to my lungs and he'll hear it. But in fact, a small lung cancer, you may not hear anything abnormal. It would require you're telling the doctor, I've had a cough for 6 weeks and it won't go away. And the doctor says, we better take an X-ray.
Well, that being said, on the opposite side, if you, it's not the situation you just set up, but let's say you've had a cough, let's say you are a smoker or a former smoker, and you've had a cough and you're a senior, and you develop some kind of pulmonary problem, and a lot of seniors are having surgeries, whether it's gallbladder or whatever it is, and they take you in, notice you have trouble breathing, you stay in the hospital maybe 3 days. I mean, obviously, by that point, they know you have the cough, and you're certainly having pulmonary problems. If they let you check out of that hospital and have not diagnosed you with that, is there a good chance that you don't have it?
Yes. I think medical tests and medical procedures and the whole process, histories and physicals, you put it all together today with modern technology, and we've got tremendous accuracy and diagnosis. And by that, I mean 95, 96, 97%. That's pretty good. It used to be 40, 50%. We used to guess at these things. But we need to be realistic about it and recognize that there's a several percent chance that you may walk out undiagnosed when you have a problem or improperly diagnosed. I'm kind of smiling here, Scott, because you and I are doing something that I have sort of accused the world of doing, and that is that we are focusing on the tip of the iceberg. You and I are talking about a problem that might affect 1 out of 1,000 of your listeners right now, but I know that 70% of them are overweight and doing nothing about it. I know that the vast majority of them, maybe 80, 85%, are jeopardizing their health, increasing their risk of heart disease, lung cancer. I could go on and on with this because they're not physically active. They're not doing 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise. And here we are talking about whether we might miss a lung cancer on an X-ray. Well, I want to tell these folks listening, get off your butts.
Well, this is the interesting. Well, this is interesting, Dr. Euline, because this was one of the things I wanted to talk about. Is that that being said, exactly the topic we're going into. Why didn't the website do well? Because you had this great book in '95, Lose Weight with Dr. Art Euline, sold very well, I think. Everybody's got a diet book out. Why did the website not go well, and what can we do? How do we address this?
Oh, that's an embarrassing question, Scott. It didn't do well because my partners and I were totally incompetent on the business side of the process. I had one of the world's most renowned obesity researchers guiding me on the science side. He helped me develop the weight loss program for the Today Show in 1975 that launched my TV career. But we did a beautiful job scientifically, but business-wise, we had no idea what we were doing, and so it was our incompetence, our lack of experience that sunk that project. I have to take full responsibility for that. I'm trying to decide what to do with that now. I'm trying to get someone else to take it over. When you first called me and said, hey, let's do some radio spots in Marion, it reminded me of the time that I went to a little town called in Taft, California. It's a very isolated town. It's a former oil drilling town. And they had huge, huge, very high incidence of hypercholesterolemia. They were all overweight. And we went into town and we did this one town project for a few months and filmed it for a television show. And the town really got together and did something about it. For the Today Show, I did the same thing in Berryville, Virginia, where the mayor challenged the town to lose weight with him, and he lost 40 pounds. We actually had a parade through the town. I was the grand marshal of the parade. And I was thinking, boy, we should do that for Marion, Ohio. We should get these people who are sitting there right now, sitting, listening to us and doing nothing, and we should challenge them to get off their butts and get healthy. How do we do that?
How do we do it? How do we get off our butts? Well, because the diets do not seem to work. The counting points, the Atkins, people are still big. What is the step here? What's the secret? Why are there books written about this by the truckload?
Well, I will tell you, every diet works for somebody, briefly. The problem with most diets is that they ask people to do things that are unsustainable. So 96-97% of the people gain the weight back. I don't know if you saw that recent report. We saw it in the New York Times, but a huge study of the former contestants of The Biggest Loser, they have all gained at least their weight back, and some of them have gained much more. And the problem was that they actually damaged their metabolism in the process, probably because they lost so much weight. Their metabolism shut down, so now they burn even fewer calories than a person of their size should be burning. So what we did differently with our weight loss program was this. We told people, we will not allow you to do a lot of things to lose weight. There are 100 things you can do, and I will allow you to choose 4 of them only for a week. And at the end of the week, I'll let you trade things. So I would ask people, all right, you said in your questionnaire you drink soda, soft drinks. Would you be willing to give up soft drinks for 1 week? Well, yeah, I could do that. How about giving up bread for a week? Ooh, no, I don't want to do that one. Would you be willing to drink a glass of water before each meal? Well, sure, that's easy. How about walking a mile? Ooh, do I have to? Yeah, you got to do something like that. Oh, okay, I'll do that one. And what we did was slowed the pace of weight loss, number one, to tolerable levels. The changes we asked people to make were so small. Would you leave 10% of your food on the plate? I know your mother told you to clean the plate, but would you? Yeah, I could try that. That's the hardest one, by the way. Could you eat more slowly? And what we found is that different people chose different behaviors. They found the ones that worked for them, and slowly but surely, they lost weight. 5% of the people using our program lost 50 pounds or more. What's most important is they were able to keep it off because the way they lost it involved such gradual, sustainable changes they could keep doing it afterward. And that's the mentality that we have to spread about this. Stop trying to do it all now. Don't lose the 50th pound. The only thing you need to think about is the next pound.
That being said, a lot of people are on and off diets, much like the Biggest Loser people, and they do lose an extraordinary amount of weight, and then they put more back on than they lost. If you have damage, how do you fix that?
No one knows. It's interesting. I'm talking to the researcher at the National Institutes of Health that did the study, and they can't answer that question. Will it ultimately recover? Probably not. Here's the really interesting question. If you lose 100 pounds as slowly as I'm telling you to lose it over a year or two, will your metabolism hang on in a normal fashion? We don't know the answer to that question. We're going to try to study that. Is it the total amount of weight lost? Is it the percentage of body weight lost? Is it the speed with which you lost the weight? No one knows the answer to that question, which is actually shocking to think that here we've been doing these diets for 40 years and no one can answer that question.
Well, here's the big question in my mind, Dr. Yulian. Let's say you go on the Atkins diet and you cut out the breads and you lose 100 pounds or whatever it is, and then and obviously you've damaged your metabolism in the process, and then you put back on the weight. But then when the weight comes back on, you decide to go back on the diet, and again, you're not ingesting any sugar, any flour, you're active, you're not having any health problems, but the weight is not coming off because your metabolism's never going to recover.
Right. Come off as quickly. It will come off, but not as easily and not as quickly. What do you do then?
What do you do?
I think what you do is change your goals. Instead of trying it all off, you change from a focus on quantity to a focus on quality. You say, you know something? I know these foods, certain foods are bad for me, and I know that certain things are unsustainable. Atkins diet, I hate the Atkins diet. Can you lose weight on it? Of course you can. Can you give up carbs for life? Of course not. So what happens is that you lose the weight, but you can't stay on the program for life. It's not possible to do that. So instead, I say, is that bread good enough to eat without butter? We've got a bakery near us. Oh, I mean, bread's heavenly. I eat a lot of bread. But I eat only one slice at a time, and I eat it without butter. Sometimes I'll put a little olive oil on. That's quality nutrition. It's whole grain. It's good for me. The research shows it's good for me. Cutting out all bread is it's a bad thing for your health. So we've got to change the mentality about this. I'm going to do unsustainable, impossible things that I hate so I can lose weight, which I know I'll gain all back again. You'd be better off not losing the weight.
So that being said, let's say you adopt a healthy diet, but because of a diet you've been on in your life, you've hurt the metabolism. Now, you still weigh 300 pounds, but you are not ingesting bad food. Are you a healthy person?
You're a healthier person. There's no question about that. And let's not ignore physical activity as part of this program. We need to stop focusing on weight. I love what you just did because you took the emphasis off weight and you turned it toward health. Are there some fit, overweight individuals? Yes, actually they are. However, they are still subject to the inflammatory chemicals that the fatting out. They are still going to be at greater risk. So my emphasis would be on health. Let's just focus on health and see what happens. And I can tell you that if we focused on health instead of on weight, you would see people slowly, very slowly, gradually, steadily begin to lose some weight. Their blood pressures would come down. They would feel better about themselves. They would be safer in terms of physical disability. And they would begin to enjoy the process of eating instead of feeling guilty about it.
With 10 minutes left, and these go by so fast, something else I wanted to touch on was depression, because I have noticed, I read an article the other day that suicide rates are up for young girls between the ages of 10 and 16. And it just seems like more people are getting depression. Now, I know when you were on last time, we talked about if you have depression, how can you deal with a panic attack, breathing exercises, and things of that nature.
Right.
But what I have seen people do now is hyperventilate. How do you combat hyperventilation without panicking if you have panic attacks and depression?
Well, it's interesting because the hyperventilation is a subconscious response to stress. Some people the stress causes them to begin to breathe faster, not necessarily very fast. Sometimes it happens so gradually it's not noticeable. And if you breathe too deeply and too rapidly for a period of time, you basically lower the body's blood level of carbon dioxide, and you create some very, very frightening symptoms. It can actually be scary. In that case, when hyperventilation is the response to stress, the old simple treatment is you rebreathe. You get a bag, a paper bag, and you literally rebreathe the same air in and out of the bag until your blood chemistry comes down normal. I think that we need to recognize that depression is a whole spectrum. There are very mild levels of depression, some people who have blue days and bad days, and there are some very, very serious levels of depression, so serious they can actually lead people to see no way out except suicide. In those cases, the brain chemistry is literally disordered. And I think the important thing, the single most important message we can give people who are feeling down, depressed, let's not, you know, put a label on it, even blue, whatever it is to talk to somebody. Talk to anybody. Talk to a relative. Talk to a friend who will help you decide if it needs to be taken to the next level, which is to talk to a doctor. But it is remarkable how helpful it can be to talk to somebody, anybody, about how you're feeling. We tend to close ourselves off, we isolate ourselves, and when we do that, the number of ways out of the depression, out of the blueness, begin to narrow down. Can you imagine being so depressed that the only way out for a young girl or young boy sees is suicide? And it happens. By the way, I think that and so often we hear people say, gosh, why did he kill himself? I never saw it coming. In fact, had we looked more carefully, we might have seen it coming. We need to reach out more to each other. The greatest, one of the most powerful medicines in the world is social connection. And we need to be more connected with each other.
You know, Dr. Yulin, we only have about 5 minutes left, and that certainly is not enough time to finish depression or even break the ice here on Alzheimer's. So I hope you come back before you get highly involved in your new project. But one thing I want to talk about, because it triggered something, what you said when we first started this interview triggered something, and obviously I'm not going to say the people's names, but this is a very specific thing that happened that ties into what you talked about earlier on with mental state and older people. Late last year, I knew a lady who was 85 years old, and I got a call one day that she had been put on hospice. And I really didn't know why. I knew, you know, she's 85 years old, and she was not aging the best. I knew she had some problems, but nothing terminal. So I didn't really know what was going on. So I went out and visited with her. And the night they put her on hospice care, and I asked her granddaughter what was actually the problem here, what was causing this. And she did have some pulmonary problems. She was on oxygen, but she'd been on that for a few years. And she had went through a bout with the infection MRSA, I believe it was. But there was nothing terminally wrong with her. And she was on hospice for, I think, about 6 weeks. And then eventually died just because she stopped eating and passed away. And it's interesting because she died on a Monday, and I visited her the Friday before. and she was still sort of conscious, but very weak because she wasn't eating. And I had said, how do you feel? And the granddaughter relayed to me that she had not taken the pain medication, that they had offered her one of the heavy pain medications, but she said she wasn't having any pain. And in the end, I really don't know. I think, you know, lack of food certainly contributed to her death, but she had no terminal illnesses. Can you will yourself to die? I mean, I don't know that you would call that a suicide, but can you get to the place where you just don't want to live and switch it on?
Well, I can't imagine that. I so treasure every moment, but I can't imagine it for myself. But yes, I can imagine that for other people. And I'm guessing that she, for whatever reason, decided it was her time and stopped eating. And can you literally kill yourself by stopping food and water? Yes. At that age, the body can only tolerate so much. Why she did it, I don't know. But could I do it? No. No, absolutely not.
But that is something, because I wonder, because a lot of people, this is a big discussion topic, and I don't know if it is in your circles, of this hospice care. Because one of the things, I mean, I certainly understand if the doctor has diagnosed you terminal. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that. But if,
right.
If you have not been diagnosed terminal, and that you just don't want to go to the hospital anymore, which is essentially what this was.
Right.
Should that be okay?
I think everybody has to answer that question for himself or herself. What are you going to do? Force feed her? Put IVs in?
Well, you're right, and I guess the end question is if there hadn't been hospice, though, would she have chosen to go to the hospital? Because
we'll never know the answer to that question, but we should keep asking it, shouldn't we?
Yeah, because it's a fascinating thing, and this is why when somebody comes on like you, it's interesting to hear a doctor talk. Because you can, there are endless things to talk about. And I think this is a service, because I think there are, I know the lung cancer thing is at the top of the list, but certainly the weight loss is not. And when you cover depression and things like this, more people are faced with it than you think. And you realize that when you're out there with people. And I'm sure you do as well.
Yes.
And it's
one of these days we'll have to hold this discussion in Marion.
We'll have to, because it's something I think people should certainly know. And I, like I said, I do hope you can come back, because Alzheimer's is something I really want to talk about, because we it is such a mysterious disease, and it seems as if when people get Alzheimer's, I'm not sure what the family goes through, but somehow we don't see the final stages, unless we have somebody in our own family, and maybe we shouldn't. President Reagan certainly put a face on it, but we didn't really see what happened, and I don't know, I don't know, showing's better than telling, I don't know. Maybe it shouldn't have been him, but it's, what exactly happens there, I think, is a mystery to most people until they go through it.
Well, let's talk about that next time.
Well, Dr. Art Ulian, I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have.
Thank you, Scott. I love being on with you.
Thank you so much. You stay well.
You too.
Bye-bye. Dr. Art Ulian. Hey, we're going to take a break. Come back with Dr. Henry Heimlich.
It wasn't a divorce, per se. It was a long, happy marriage. That.
And legendary Dean of the White House Press Corps, Helen Thomas.
No, he won't call on me. I had two news conferences. I was in his face. I had my hand up and so forth, but he's for my questions.